This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place, whether you're in the mood for a heartwarming student-run theater production, a music festival designed to make you shake a leg, or a dramatic comedy. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. The arts aren't the first thing that come to mind when you think about St. Bernard Parish, but a recent trip to Chalmette left me in awe. The massive cultural arts center, with its huge centerpiece, a 420-seat state-of-the-art theater, took my breath away. Public school students, including some graduates of Chalmette High, are spending part of their summer here preparing for a production of Disney's The Little Mermaid. Charles Cassar is St. Bernard School's Cultural Arts and Special Events Administrator. He beams with pride as he talks about the $30 million Cultural Arts Center, which opened in 2011, a silver lining from Hurricane Katrina.
It was really an amazing facility designed by Wagner and Ball. It's 99,000 square feet. It has a profound teaching stage, fully equipped with so many special effects opportunities. Our stage is probably larger than the Sanger. We have more technical equipment than does the Sanger. The opportunity to bring to life theatrical effects are only rivaled in Mahalia when large touring companies come to town. And our students are getting to participate in that kind of theater experience, both from a technical standpoint as well as from a theatrical performance standpoint. We certainly need to consider the tremendous generosity of the Arlene and Joseph Miro Foundation and Mr. Albert Carey. Their generosity has truly opened the door for students to perform in this building.
Fred Hebert was in earshot of our conversation. He's a graduate of Chalmette High and technical director for St. Bernard Schools. He marvels at the bells and whistles, the technical toys available to his students.
The students have more than anything that they would have, even at some of the local colleges. We have a fully functioning fly system for scenery. We are also capable of flying people as well. Then for lighting, we have all the new gadgets, all the new toys that you would see at a rock concert, all the way to a regular production. Then we have special effects where we are doing low-lying fog, where the students are learning about liquid nitrogen and being able to fog the stage, and all the way to sound, where they are working with not just live productions where they're miking students, but also post-production work where they're working on Pro Tools, to where in a recording studio aspect they can get a certification and actually go into the working world if they choose to right after high school.
The summer program that lures kids back to school on this day is called the Performing Arts Academy. It began 16 years ago in the school gym, an idea born from a simple question asked by one of Cassar's students.
When we were learning about the Renaissance period, he asked, "Mr. Cassar, I don't get it. Is God not making any more Michelangelos and Leonardo da Vinci's and Raphael's?" And, you know, Diane, I couldn't answer him at first. But the more I thought about it, I think God's still making them. It's what are we doing to find them and to develop them and to give young people the opportunity to let their talents really shine. And that's the goal of this program.
And it became a family affair for Cassar, as his wife and daughters provide integral support.
It's true. I'm very fortunate to have an amazing wife who is very much an artist. Her costume work is extraordinary. And my children had the privilege of growing up in a home filled with art and lots of family and lots of love and lots of community. Our work was the school, and my children learned that other kids like themselves wanted to sing, wanted to act, wanted to dance, and we all did it together.
His daughters, music director Annalise Cassar and artistic director Ariana Cassar.
There's nothing like training others to do what you love. There's nothing like it. I guess I would like to reiterate what Annalise said. There's definitely a call beckoning. You know, getting to work with students, I think, is a high like no other.
If only she were here, she'd know just what to say. She'd firmly and yet gently help the girl to find her way. She'd know what to forbid and what we must allow. She'd have the strength and patience that I lack somehow.
Rashard Hooper is a recent graduate of Chalmette High. He is playing King Triton, the Little Mermaid's father. He says his experiences in this program, both technical and on stage, helped shape his future.
It has been a very large stepping stone. The instructors at Loyola came to one of the performances, and that is where they first saw me, first heard my voice. And from that moment, I was like, I want to work with them. This is where I want to be. That's where I want to go. So this is kind of what started me on the college path. I don't even know what I'd be studying if it wasn't for this program.
Lena Bowie is one of the younger cast members.
I am a seahorse singer.
When I asked why she chooses to spend summer vacation at school, she told me,
I just think that the summer program gives you a lot to do. It actually is really fun.
You will definitely get that warm and fuzzy feeling when you see the accomplishments of these young people who are putting their best foot forward as they strive to new heights in the performing arts. But you don't have to take my word for it. They are inviting you to see the production and their new theater home. Disney's The Little Mermaid opens Thursday at the Chalmette Cultural Arts Center, with weekend performances running through July 2nd. More information is online at SBPSB, that's St. Bernard Parish School Board, .org, or eventbrite.com. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Whenever my next guest drops by, I know it's time for a festival, and he's hoping you like your snap beans on the salty side. The Louisiana Cajun Zydeco Festival kicks off this weekend in Armstrong Park, and Scott Ages with the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation is here with the details. Welcome back.
Hey, Diane. Great to see you again. Thank you for having me.
So, what do salty snap beans have to do with a Cajun Zydeco music festival?
Well, the phrase Zydeco is said to date back to an adaptation of a French expression, les haricots sont pas salés, the snap beans ain't salty, and les haricots eventually sort of morphed its way into the word Zydeco, and that's kind of where we're at. That's what we have.
What are your thoughts as the festival enters its 11th celebration? What keeps it going strong?
The Cajun Zydeco Festival is produced and presented by the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, which is the nonprofit that owns the Jazz Fest. And our role is to use the money from Jazz Fest for free programs that we do all year long. And we're active mainly in the areas of education, economic development, and cultural enrichment. We put on at least one free concert a month in our venue, the Jazz and Heritage Center on Rampart Street. And we also do four free festivals that we do for the community each year. This is the 11th annual Cajun Zydeco Festival, which is one of the free events that we put on. And all of these festivals are designed to do a few things. Bring a little taste of Jazz Fest to the community throughout the year, and also to identify a specific aspect of what goes into this crazy gumbo mixture of a culture that we have. All of these festivals started in the post-Katrina context of New Orleans, when the main objective was to create more employment opportunities for our musicians and help bring our musicians home. So the festivals have a lot of things going into them, and they all feature pretty much the same formula: great music, great food, and beautiful art. And we also add in kids' activities and other things to keep folks interested in. So they are, by design, a little bit of a slice of Jazz Fest. Now, the Cajun Zydeco Festival, of course, is sort of like if you were to just have the Fado Do stage and make that your festival. So it's Cajun and Zydeco music from Southwest Louisiana. And one of the things that we're really proud of is that we are continuing to present a really awesome lineup of very high caliber music that really spans a wonderful gamut. We have everything from the classic, most famous, legendary artist in Cajun music, 85-year-old legend D.L. Menard, who is famous mostly for his song La Porte en Arrière, which around our office we call the Dirty Song. And you got that. So we go from historic legends like D.L. Menard to famous stalwarts of the national touring scene like Gino Delafosse, Grammy-winning Chubby Carrier, and Los Bayou Ramblers. Then we also have some of our very favorite New Orleans-based artists, Bruce D'Agrapont and his Cajun band, and Sun Pie and Louisiana Sunspots. And then we also have some really cool up-and-coming artists that really aren't very well known in this area, like Cedric Ballou from Lake Charles, Louisiana, who's burning up the dance halls around there, but really hasn't been seen in New Orleans, hardly at all.
Now, how do you describe Cajun and Zydeco music? What's the difference?
One of the things that's interesting about Cajun and Zydeco music is that they evolved in southwest Louisiana, 100 or so miles west of New Orleans, right around the same time that jazz was evolving in urban New Orleans. So they have that in common. They were very much folk music based around fiddles and accordions and things like triangles and washboards for percussion. At a certain point, probably in the 1960s, they started to diverge stylistically, where Cajun music became more akin to country music and bluegrass in the sense that it was quite acoustic-based, really revolving around the waltz rhythm, featuring the button accordion that plays kind of the diatonic or blues scale. You have your fiddle, you have your washboard and your triangle, and maybe an acoustic guitar. And that was the basis of that music. And so it's more folky. While Zydeco music, thanks to people like Clifton Chenier, became more R&B based, I would say, with a thumping bass rhythm, very percussive, very hard charging, that chanka-chank sound that we talk about sometimes. So still traditionally with the rub board, keeping that percussiveness going, but with a big booming bass and really fast rhythms.
And new this year is an interview stage, something similar to what we see at Jazz Fest?
Exactly, where we will be doing interviews with some of our popular musicians and also some of the people who are demonstrating in what's also new, which is our Folklife craft demonstration area. If you're familiar with the guy at Jazz Fest who pounds the filet powder,
yes,
you know that guy? His name is Lionel Key from Baton Rouge. So we're doing very similar Folklife demonstrations as you would see at Jazz Fest. So we have Calvin Ardoin. He builds and repairs stringed instruments, fiddles, cellos. So he'll be out there demonstrating his traditional craft. Another guy whose name escapes me at the moment who builds and repairs accordions. So we'll have traditional accordion making. We also have a farrier, which is a horseshoe smith, somebody who makes and repairs horseshoes with, you know, fire and hot metal and an anvil and all that fun stuff. And a few others. And so we will be interviewing people about their lives, about the thing that inspires their creativity and what their inspirations are.
So this will be like a mini Jazz Fest with a focus on Cajun and Zydeco music.
Always. We're always trying to bring a little bit of Jazz Fest to all of the festivals that we present. I mean, how can you go wrong?
Sounds like a lot of fun, Scott.
We try. What can I tell you?
Scott Ages with the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation. Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The 11th annual Louisiana Cajun Zydeco Festival takes place Saturday and Sunday in Armstrong Park. In the French Quarter, the NOLA Project teams up with Le Petit Theatre for their first ever co-production. It's only a play, an outrageous farce by Tony and Emmy Award-winning author Terrence McNally. An all-star local cast fills the bill as the production closes out Le Petit's historic 100th season. NOLA Project Artistic Director A.J. Allegra joins me with cast members Cecile Montaigne and Sean Patterson. Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, Diane.
Tell me, how did this partnership come about?
Well, the partnership was
an idea of the play that I brought to Max Williams, the artistic director of Le Petit Theatre, and I thought that this kind of love-hate letter to the theater, and I say that in the best possible way, I thought that it would be a great thing to close out their 100th anniversary season, because, you know, something that just celebrates the very art form of theater. You know, theater can be a little bit navel-gazing sometimes, but in a good way. You know, plays like Noises Off, or plays like It's Only a Play, or plays like The Dresser, you know, things that are generally like about the theater life and about what it's like to be in the theater. And this is a great example of one, and it was just recently revived on Broadway with a hilarious updated script by Terrence McNally.
Tell me a little bit about Terrence McNally.
He kind of runs the gamut. He writes a wide variety of stuff. He writes a lot of stories involving, you know, gay men. He's from Corpus Christi, Texas, so he writes a lot about his experiences growing up gay in the American South. But this play is really kind of a wild departure, I think, from a lot of his more serious work. It's just a farcical, slapstick, just goofball paean to the theater.
What's the storyline?
So the premise is that it's opening night of a brand new American play on Broadway, and all of your typical characters are present. So you have, you know, the moony-eyed coat boy who just got off a bus from somewhere out west. You have the TV star who's best friends with the playwright, and the playwright's making his Broadway debut. You have an actress who's reinvigorating her career after a rough patch in Hollywood. You have the producer who means well, who's pretty dim, and then the British director who's nuts but very well respected.
There's also the most vicious critic in New York who has ended up at this party as well.
Mm-hmm. They're all kind of trapped in this room together waiting for the Ben Brantley New York Times review that will make or break this play, and everyone has a lot riding on it, so the stakes are very high.
Now, I imagine that this is one production that you all personally connect with.
I remember when NOLA Project first formed, you know, we would stay up late at night on the night that we heard that, you know, David Cuthbert was publishing his Times-Picayune review. And, you know, we all lived in the same house together, so it'd be funny. We'd all be gathered around like someone's laptop just hitting refresh, refresh, refresh on the entertainment page waiting to see, did the review pop up? So I think it's still, you know, today in New York, the New York Times, you know, a Broadway show is reviewed by countless newspapers, not only in New York, but I mean nationally. But the New York Times mm-hmm. is the review that matters. And you can throw away all the others if the New York Times gives you a rave. And so that's really what the play is. And I think that as actors, you know, people take different stances. Some people say, I'd never read my review. Some people say, but I think that's a very noble thing. However, I personally, it's not only as an actor, but as an artistic director, as a director, I'm constantly reading reviews. I mean, anything that has a, you know, that our company name pops up, we have Google searches that, you know, Google alerts. So it is a nerve-wracking experience.
I think even people who say that they don't read reviews are being a little bit disingenuous. I think everyone skims for their own name and looks to see what is said about them. And some people treasure in a kind of a twisted way the terrible things that have been said about them in print. And one of the things that's really funny about this show is that it sort of celebrates these gloriously awful reviews that some of us have earned over the years. Whether fairly or unfairly. There are several moments in the show where I think almost everyone on stage has to endure hearing something just wretchedly skewering said about them. And it's kind of great fun to be able to play those moments.
Personally, I think that you always remember, for some reason, you remember the bad stuff better than you remember the good stuff. And that's just a thing that all actors experience.
So tell me about your characters.
So I play Julia Butter, who is the very well-meaning producer who really tries, but she's just there's just not a lot upstairs. So I really care about everyone. I want it to go well. It's my first solo production on Broadway, but I'm just not very smart. Most of my fun moments are terrible malapropisms of things that we should all be saying correctly, and I just don't.
I play Peter Austin, who is the playwright. When we started working on the show, AJ described him as sort of the most sincere, honest, like the moral center of the play. And he really is. He's just kind of this nebbishy mensch who...
He's an optimist.
He is an optimist. And in the theater, we need more of them, I think. He's just hoping that this goes well because he has so much riding on it. Everyone in the room is sort of dependent upon his success. And he bears the weight of that like Atlas with the world on his shoulders, I think.
Can you guys share a scene from the production?
We're all eagerly awaiting Peter's arrival at the party. He's kind of like mysteriously disappeared. He doesn't take a bow. He's not at the party. And we're all, I particularly am very nervous that something terrible has happened to him because he's written me this note. So he finally shows up and we're very excited. And he finds out his best friend is there. So this is a little bit from his very recent arrival. Where have you been? You had us both so worried.
You promised not to laugh?
Of course not.
I've been walking the streets thinking about what it means to be a playwright.
That's so dear.
No, I mean it.
So do I. That's a wonderful thing to be thinking about. I wish more playwrights did.
A Streetcar Named Desire opened at the same theater we did tonight, December 3rd, 1947. Tennessee Williams paced at the back of our orchestra the same way I did. I could feel him. Ilya Kazan paced with him. I felt them both. I bet they held hands and squealed like schoolgirls when that curtain went up. It's from our stage that Marlon Brando first yelled, "Stella!" And Blanche DuBois told the world that she had always depended on the kindness of strangers. We have a lot to live up to tonight. It depends on us to remind this city that there is more to Broadway than guest appearances or special effects and revivals or another play from London or another Disney movie made live. We are an original American play. We must make that count for something.
Amen.
I think the audience is in for a really good laugh.
We hope so.
I hope.
Who else is in the cast?
We have Leslie Castan, Ricky Graham.
James Bartel, Alex Ates.
And Keith Clavery.
Wow.
I think that the audience will be delighted by the memory of this one time that these seven particular actors, who are all pretty well known on New Orleans stages, you know, came together to do an ensemble comedy. And there is really no star of the show. The star is the play and the seven of them together.
The NOLA Project's artistic director, A.J. Allegra, and cast members Cecile Montaigne and Sean Patterson. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us again.
The NOLA Project and Liberty Theater present Terrence McNally's It's Only a Play. Performances run through June 25th at Liberty Theater, 616 St. Peter Street. That's our show for this week. Support for Inside the Arts comes from the Hellas Foundation. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.